Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's Tuesday, May 14th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Why Waimea is for families, or is that Kamuela?
Turn right at the Star of Gladness. You can't miss it.
Get in touch with your feminine side. Lead.
All roads lead to trails. Well, the good ones do.
And the world view from Al Jazeera, a lovely backyard fountain you won't find in a garden, plus reality checking those earmarks. Often say that a good vacation has something for everyone. Family travel makes that a little more dicey, perhaps with the exception of a beach getaway. Next month, Parents Magazine spotlights its 10 best beach town destinations for family fun, and the only one in Hawaii is in Kamuela, or is that Waimea? Whichever way it's referenced, will this national attention change the community, or is change happening anyway? Longtime Waimea resident, teacher, and parent, Sydney Wecking happens to be in Honolulu this week, and she joins us now. Thanks for coming in.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, when you heard about this, and obviously it's fun when you get mentioned in national press, but first of all, what did you make of the fact that they refer to it as Kamuela?
Well, for us, the people that live there, we call it Waimea, and we're 2,500 feet away from at 2,500 foot altitude. So not considering ourselves so much a beach town, and yet it's so accessible. And for me in Hawaii, having lived there for 25 years now, the focus for me on the article is family, the fact that we are really developing into a family-friendly community.
Which is good for people who live there, too. But was there any desire on your part or anyone that you know to kind of let them know that it's really Waimea? Or to somehow acknowledge that they have a better line into the community than just calling it Kamuela?
I think for me, there's an identity that we have that in calling it Waimea. There's the kama'aina, the sense that there's a belonging that we have to our own community, and yet very friendly and open to visitors. It's what supports our community in many ways.
Do you see this going into any sort of new branding by some of the merchants and others who would benefit by having families come?
I think that's already happening. I see down at the hotels that there's a lot of activities provided for young children so that parents can have their vacation as well. And that there's summer camps, there's programs, there's arts and crafts. There's just so much going on to support families in the community because it's open to the community members as well as the people that are coming to visit. So the merchants are creating a family-friendly environment, not specific to just visitors, but really to our community.
Is there any concern that somehow with a spotlight of this nature that it will become a little bit more saccharine?
That's a good point, and I don't think so. I think that we've had the benefit of being on the Big Island and so a little more secluded from the rest of the tourist industry, so that the people that come there, many of them are really invested in learning about nature. There's a lot of education going on for kids and for parents about how Hawaii is unique and independent from much of the world, and wanting to really grow that community and welcome people to that community with a focus on really connecting to the land and to the spirit of Hawaii.
Which seems to be a little bit different, Sydney, than, say, the list that Parents Magazine did in 2010, where the beach destination was the Hilton Hawaiian Village. And nothing against the Hilton Hawaiian Village, because there's a lot of fun to be had there, too. But that's a vastly different experience than going to a beach town whether you consider it a beach town or not, for whatever reason they do, but for going to a town like Cumwela.
You bring up a very good point. What I'm seeing in our community is really wanting people to learn about the roots of the Hawaiian people, about their culture and their spirituality. There's the Paniolo Preservation Society. There's taro farming. So getting people who come to visit to understand really the essence of Hawaii versus the come to the beach town and just lie in the sun and, you know, drink Mai Tais.
Or see the same Starbucks on the corner or a lot of the same shops that you can see in any town mall USA.
Yeah, we have a uniqueness that's very, very special, and the people that live in our community are invested in maintaining that.
And not exploiting it.
And not exploiting it.
So at this point, with this kind of press going on, when you talk to friends and others who have businesses there, looking to, if they're not going to exploit it, at least to somehow create a different tack than they've been using in past, somehow to, well, you might as well use a little bit the fact that Parents Magazine is given this designation, or they don't care at all.
No, they do care because it's an opportunity to connect with people in a new way. And really paying attention to the education and to the opportunities for the young kids and the parents, and to provide support for families to do activities or to participate in ways that are unique to Hawaii. So there's an opportunity there, and it doesn't need to be exploiting the opportunity and to put the resources out there in a way that is superficial, as you said, saccharine, but really connecting people and providing them an opportunity to have a unique experience.
Do you think new businesses will now be drawn to Waimea?
I'd like that. I'd like to see that. And I think that that's happening already. There's a lot of talk about, as our economy comes back, what's available now and what do we want to offer to people.
What do you think needs to come to Waimea and Kamuela?
I think that more opportunity for families in the role of education and participating in getting out into nature and out on the land to having the experience of being outdoors and all that Hawaii, all that the Big Island offers. I'd like to see more opportunity for nature hikes, for education as far as what's going on the island as it grows, and sustainability. What are we doing to create a sustainable island community? And I think with doing that, it's an opportunity to have an impact around the world because we do draw visitors from all over the world.
That sounds a lot like ecotourism, which has been tried in past. But is this just sort of the moment when talent and opportunity could possibly lead to greater success?
I believe so. And I think that with the movement worldwide, internationally now, to connecting people to our Earth and to what needs to happen to make it possible for us to survive, that the Big Island is a place where we have so much available as nature's resources. And now with sustainability being a focus in the development, that more and more people are coming to the island, so coming to the Energy Lab, coming to Volcano, to learn more about the resources that the Earth offers us, where we are not compromising and damaging the Earth. So it's an opportunity for people to learn, to experience, to celebrate, and to take home something that they wouldn't get anywhere else in the world.
And certainly having the designation in Parents Magazine that'll come out next month isn't going to hurt either.
Yes.
Sydney Wecking, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Sydney Wecking has lived in Hawaii since the 1960s and in Waimea since the 1980s as a parent, teacher, counselor, and now life coach. She's seen Waimea evolve from a town of cow pastures and no streetlights to an eclectic village that attracts people from all over the world, and now families looking for a family-friendly beach vacation, at least as identified by Parents Magazine.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Later in the show, riding genuine waves of awareness, earning the earmarks, and the news from Al Jazeera. But first, a hot splash in the backyard.
Today's quiz begins in the backyard of the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory on November 14, 1959. For months, scientists had been monitoring over 1,000 tiny earthquakes deep beneath the Big Island's Kilauea Iki crater. But on that particular fall afternoon, there was a tenfold spike in the magnitude and the number of the quakes. The area shook violently in the next 5 hours as magma rumbled toward the surface, destroying the subterranean rocks and boulders in its path. At 8:08 p.m., the magma finally bubbled over to the surface of the crater, creating a chain of fissures 1,300 feet long. The flow was so intense that just 2 hours later, the chain had doubled in length, and a spurting lava fountain had grown to as high as 100 feet. All this was just day one of the first episode. Over the next weeks, scientists watched millions of cubic meters of lava spew into the crater and erupt into the sky. Your quiz this morning, can you name the maximum recorded height of the lava fountain? We'll shoot you the answer in about 20 minutes.
Hi, good morning. I'm Susan Schultz from Tinfish Press. You're listening to member-supported HPR 2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Following the light, watching the motion of the waves and the flight of seabirds, ancient Polynesian navigators found their way to Hawaii and traveled the ocean at will using ways of navigation that later were all but forgotten. The revival of that ancient craft became one of the great stories of modern Hawaii when a generation rediscovered its heritage through the voyages of the Hokulea. That story has now been given a comprehensive treatment by a man who witnessed it at first hand. Sam Lowe is the author of Hawaiki Rising, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Sam.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Pretty good. You've really taken on this story in all its magnitude, and it's a huge story because of the way it reflects so many other stories. Do you agree?
I do. The wonderful thing about Hokulea is that it came about at a time when Hawaiian culture was really at a low ebb.
In need of a renaissance.
In need of a renaissance. And as Herb Kirpkani was one of the founders of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, and as he said, the canoe is a central artifact of the culture, and that by reviving voyaging, by actually building a replica of an ancient canoe, he hoped that it would bring about a revival of all of those other aspects of culture that were part of it. Hula, the curing practices, navigation itself, astronomy, language, and ultimately it did. Hokulea has voyaged 140,000 miles. It's recreated all of the ancient sea routes, and I think that it was the spark of what we now see all around us, the revival of Hawaiian culture.
In terms of getting people to look around and say, what else is in need of revival, right?
Exactly. I mean, in 1995, I think it was that we graduated the first class of high school students that had been in an immersion program and studying the Hawaiian language, mm-hmm. speaking Hawaiian mm-hmm. Throughout their education. And now, when I first came here in 1964, very few people spoke Hawaiian, and now it's really become a common language here in the islands, and it's come back strong. And I think that is one of the aspects of the revival that Hokulea spurred.
Well, I mean, Hawaiian history can be seen as an exercise post-Captain Cook in colonialism. And one of the things that happens with colonialism is that the colonizer suppresses whatever the people, the indigenous people, were good at. The colonizer doesn't want indigenous people to think they were good at much of anything, right?
Exactly. Hula was banned. The language was pretty much suppressed as well. The lands were taken. The culture was really in danger in the 60s and 70s of much of it being lost. So I think that voyaging was that spark that mm-hmm. really brought back an interest and a sense of pride by navigating in the ancient way without charts, without instruments, and by navigating and following the ancient sea paths, this resurgence of pride in heritage of what really were the world's greatest seafarers came about. And I think Hokulea was definitely a part of the revival of Hawaiian culture.
Well, when you look at the art, science, whatever you call it, of wayfinding as it was, as Mao kept it alive and passed it on to Nainoa Thompson, it is extraordinary what can be done, absolutely extraordinary, with the naked eye, without necessarily the benefit of stars, right?
Right. Well, I guess on all of the voyages that I've been on, the most spectacular moment is always landfall.
Mm-hmm.
And as a documenter on Hokulea, it was my job to record what went on board. And I was always watching Nainoa, mm-hmm. our navigator.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember coming back to Hawaii in 2000 from Tahiti. We'd been sailing northeast for maybe 24, 25 days. Nainoa then ordered us to turn west. So we all knew that the island was nearby.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know where it was because we had this gentle mist that was coming over the canoe. We couldn't see very far ahead of us. So I went back and I asked Nainoa, "Where are we?" And he said, "Well, over there," pointing just a little bit off the port bow, "is Hilo." Now, this is after 2,400 miles.
Yeah, right.
And I'm thinking, oh.
How do you know?
Well, yeah, how do you know? I can't see it. None of us can see it.
Sure.
And he said, yeah. And I said that. How do you know? He said, well, if you look ahead, you can see the mist. Of course, he knew where he was in terms of latitude. He understands using the stars to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So when he turned, he knew he was in the approximate location, but 10 miles from Hilo.
Yeah, right.
He said, if you look ahead, you can see this mist wafting over the canoe, and ahead of us it seems to stall, and on either side it seems to move, and I couldn't see it.
Hmm.
So he said, there's some there's land there, Mauna Kea is there.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the sun went down, he said, you might notice that if you look to the right and to the left, you will see that there's a little bit more redness in that mist, and ahead of us it's darker. I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
So about 2 minutes later, he ordered us to turn to starboard, and we began to feel it, the crew. We began to feel that there was something large nearby, but mm-hmm. we couldn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the rail, and we peered out. And then just before sunset, the mist lifted, and there were the lights of Hilo.
Amazing.
And this was after 2,400 miles, and as you say, sometimes he couldn't even see the stars. It was the waves, the swells,
sure.
the other aspects that helped him steer.
Well, it's a way of seeing, and it obviously took him quite a while to acquire that.
Exactly,
but,
yes.
You know, where you and I might just see the surface of the ocean, he would see a great deal.
Yes, and he spent a year with Mao. Mao came to live with Nainoa Thompson, and they would go out in a little boat and study the stars, study the swells, the wind patterns. And that was an immersion program for Nainoa with a master navigator, Mao.
Mao being the man in whom the ancient arts resided.
Right, from Satawal, he was the man that really passed on his skills and that sparked this ability of our navigators to find land.
Scary that it came down to just one man, isn't it?
Well, there were a handful of them, mm-hmm. but it really, he was the one that stepped out of his culture and that came to Hawaii and that passed on his skills to Hawaiian navigators.
Mm-hmm.
And actually by doing that, it was really interesting. He revived his own culture.
Well, it's really one of the extraordinary meetings that, you know, it's a little moment in history that sort of sends out concentric waves to a lot of other moments in history.
That's right.
And I think that's kind of what you went for in your book, isn't it? To sort of, it isn't just a story of an ocean voyage. It's a story of all the things that voyage brought into consciousness.
I kind of like to think of it as a story of two things, roots and revival. It's a story of a young man growing up in Hawaii, rediscovering his roots through voyaging and through this gift of this great teacher, Maupialug. And then by following the paths of our ancestors, by voyaging all of these ancient roots, it spurred a revival of Hawaiian culture in general.
Sam, great to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Sam Lowe is the author of Hawaiki Rising. He's made three separate voyages aboard the Hokulea, and his book comes out this month. You can learn more about it on our HPR website.
Support for today's programming comes from Four Seasons Resort Maui's Vintage Wine Weekend. 3 days of wine, food, and special events with vintners, sommeliers, chefs, and fellow wine enthusiasts. May 24th through 26th. Maui.fourseasons.com.
Talk of the Nation provides you with the day's news and more, the experiences and opinions of people around the country and around the world. I'm Neil Conan. When you're looking for the latest news and how it affects you, your family, your neighbors, and your life, turn to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Estelle Inoki of Honolulu, Paul Kirkman of Kihei, and Bernice and Robert Littman of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:28. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Honolulu officials are struggling to find money to pay for raises for city workers, but the city council seems to have no problem finding millions of dollars for pet projects in their home districts. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Good morning.
Hello, Beth Ann.
We're talking about earmarks here, which I thought had kind of fallen out of fashion.
Well, at the federal level, perhaps, we all know about that, although Dan Inouye managed to get money for Hawaii. But we're talking about the city council here. So we're talking about the county of Oahu, Honolulu City County. We're talking $8 million, probably, this money being funneled to nonprofits and special interest groups. Part of the problem that is raised by this is there's already a $5.5 million grant in aid program created to help these kinds of groups. So why do you need this additional $8 million, especially when other groups, as you indicated at the beginning, are seeking more money from the city?
Well, I mean, that's the question. But the grant and aid program is different from these earmarks, which have, you know, just exponentially been rising. Well, not exponentially, but certainly over double what,
certainly
they,
climbing,
what they were.
Yes.
And the fact that, just in general, the fact that Breen Haramoto is looking at this and pointing a finger at it and saying, you know, earmarks, this is maybe not, or it shouldn't be, the trend.
You know, the council member, I'm going to read a quote from him. I'm concerned that now, outside of this voter-approved process, he's talking about the grants and aid program, council members are inserting into budget line items with named nonprofits that we're giving money to, but this isn't what voters signed us up to do. He's concerned that there hasn't been a vetting process or public oversight of this. Mind you, some of these projects are very worthwhile. We're talking about nonprofits and so forth.
Yeah, this is not meant to bash nonprofits in any sort of way. We're just talking about the process and how transparent this is, and really getting a sense that there's an approval and accountability with all of this.
Now, on the other side, Council Chair Ernie Martin, he defends the process. He says, look, you know, nine council members had to sign off on this, as well as the mayor's administration. Interestingly enough, Ernie Martin's district has benefited the most from this money. About $6 million worth going to Wahiawa, North Shore, and so forth. Mind you, he also has the largest district geographically, but how interesting that the chair is benefiting the most, or rather his constituents are.
And not to cast aspersions, because there are probably very good reasons why that's happening. But again, the idea that voters and taxpayers and everybody should be aware of why that's happening and why certain groups are getting, and perhaps why there are others who might be just as worthy are not getting.
That's right. And this is in addition to the other areas that the city has to fund, you know, sewers and paving roads and potholes and so forth. We're talking about $7 million in bus route cuts that are trying to be restored. And then there's that $26 million to deal with those salary increases for the union contract. So that's a lot of money to deal with, and every dollar, every $1 million becomes all the more precious, especially when $8 million is going to these nonprofits and special interest groups. $8 million.
So the bottom line is that all of these earmarks in some ways do circumvent the process and shouldn't be taken for granted and should be maybe a little bit more available to public scrutiny.
Exactly. That's Civil Beats view.
All right. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks.
Thank you. Sure, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. Over the last month, we've seen public speculation steadily make headlines whether Fed Vice Chair Janet Yellen will succeed Ben Bernanke. If it happens, she'd be the first woman to run the Fed and the first woman to run a major central bank. A couple of generations ago, that might have been unthinkable. But while women have made great strides, we still often talk about the pay disparity between women and men. Recently, I talked with researcher, author, and thought leader Tracy Willen-Dalgenty to find out whether there's more talk than money in the progress of women in business.
Women have certainly made a lot of movement, particularly in recent years, across the board in legislative small business, Olympics, military, as you've mentioned. I think a lot of attention has been brought out by some of the recent books on how men own the world or rule the world. And so let me just clarify, because we did a research study and it was quite interesting. It was on women in leadership, and we asked men and women to rank and rate women and men in 21st century leadership attributes. And what we found is that women rated women highest on all of the attributes and characteristics of modern day leaders. But not all men measured men highest. So then I said, well, let's take this a little deeper and let's look at generations. And what we found is that generation in X and Y, which is the under 50 at this point, were gender agnostic, which is really pointing to a segment of society that is seeing differences. And it's quite interesting because that segment of society is boomer men, which is 50 and up. And then if you extrapolate who is in power in Fortune 500 companies, if you look at where the CEOs are, they're all men 55 and up, and actually predominantly white male. So I think it's very easy for people to say, okay, in the current day time, we have the power being held in firms that people look at to measure themselves by boomer men. But there's a couple of things that you need to think about. One is retirement. It's been postponed, so it feels like it's taking a longer time. But number two, it's pending. So if you look at the pipeline, which is really women who over half the workforce, and Generation X and Y, which is the balance, right, the other less 18%, we have a large pipeline coming through the system that really don't have or see the same biases perhaps of generations before.
So we're just about at that point where, for example, the financial community was a few years ago, knowing that there was going to be this great transference of wealth. Now we're going to have a great transference of ideology?
Well, I would say that we are at a tipping point, and that's why we did this research study, because we're seeing significant leaps and bounds in so many different sectors and areas. We also see this pipeline of women who are highly educated and highly motivated with many more occupational options than in the past. Let's face it, most people from earlier generations, including myself, only really looked at the public sector or at corporations as employment venues. But now you can start your own business, you can absorb businesses, you can franchise, you can be a startup, you can work for nonprofits and for profits. So there's a lot more options, and women are taking those options. So I would say that we're at a tipping point, but you always have to remember, as some of the women who I interviewed in this study stated, that once individuals join a firm, if the culture of the firm is oppressive, that is, you know, you can have people who come into the firm who are very agnostic about anything, but if they're put into a system that changes their biases, then you may not have the outcomes that it projects, right? So the data is the data, but then you have to look at the environments that people are put in.
In other words, real life. So for example, those of us who were told, darling, you can be anything, and actually believe that, there is this feeling of somehow that we've been betrayed by not being able to see all of this happening now in various workplaces, but you're saying it's because we're only looking at a narrow margin of them, that change is coming, but still it's going to have to sync with real people and real needs and real change in a very interpersonal way.
Well, I think the other change that is occurring is that, and you'll see this in Generation Y, which is the millennial generation, and Generation X, out of frustration that they haven't moved in companies, is that individuals are more likely to take control of their careers, right? So in the past, we let the company take control of our career, and we stayed there, and we endured. But today, the younger generations are taking more control of their careers and saying, if I don't like the way the culture of the firm is treating me, whether I'm young or my gender, I'm going to move. And so you'll see more shifts in the younger generations than in previous generations. And I think that's a good thing, because it sends a message that, hey, I'm not going to hang around if you're not treating me the same as other people in the firm.
When we talk about salary and trying to understand the differences in salaries and getting a real bead on what areas of labor might be a place to either start or somehow, you know, transcend into, all of those things mean that you have to have information. Now, the Bureau of Labor puts out a great many reports. How is it that we can not really have a very simple way of finding out what positions pay what without having to go through perhaps, you know, some of these websites where there's a paywall?
Yeah, so I hear your point. So there's a couple of things, and I agree with you on the BLS data, because I go through it myself. You know, I look at it to say, okay, where are the high growth areas? You know, so we know that technology is a growth area. We know that healthcare is a growth area. We know potentially down the road, manufacturing may be a growth area, and business services. But then you also have to look at where you live and what the realities are, because depending on where you live, you have different sectors. So in where I live, for example, high tech is the predominant sector. I mean, there's other industries here. But I encourage people to look at the salary ratings, which is payscale.com, Glassdoor, type in and look at what they're doing now and their zip code so they can figure out salary parity. I also would look at the very targeted job boards, because the job boards will tell you exactly what's being paid, and it does vary by state. Quite frankly, you know, certain states have to have higher or do have higher pay grades than other states just based on the cost of living. So, for example, someone in California is going to have a different salary range than someone who's living in Charlottesville, Virginia. And the last area is networking with recruiters. Now, that can be pretty hard if you don't know recruiters in your field. But through your own networks, if you can find recruiters, they really have their thumb on the pulse of what people are getting paid for. And if they're looking at nationally at a sector like finance, they can give you a good idea. Or if they're looking locally at a certain firm or industry, they can help you out. So there are sources out there, but it isn't always in a neat little package, as you stated.
So the bottom line really is, Tracy, you need to keep casting your eye about and not getting yourself pigeonholed by your own volition.
Well, I'll tell you what the bottom line is, because I did crunch the data. On average, people are only spending about an hour and a half on personal career development, but they're spending about 2,700 plus hours sleeping a year. And the reason I compare those two is because you spend a third of your life working and a third of your life sleeping. So my sense is that people really need to take their careers into their own hands and be much more aggressive in how they approach themselves, more like a service or a product, right? Because let's face it, we're living longer, we are our own income, and we have to think about how we're going to live and finance ourselves for the long haul.
Tracy Warren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tracy Willen-Delgente, Ph.D., leads national conversations on the impact of technology on society, work, and education. She's a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Media X program. She's also a former Silicon Valley executive who's held leadership positions at Apple, HP, Cisco Systems, and the Apollo Group. Her latest book is Women Lead: Career Perspectives from Workplace Leaders.
In August and September of 1959, scientists detected thousands of tiny earthquakes underneath Kilauea Iki Crater on the Big Island. Suddenly, on November 14th, the earthquakes increased tenfold as the magma that had been swelling beneath the crater rocketed toward the surface. At 8:08 p.m., the magma burst through the crater in one of the most impressive lava displays ever recorded. Over the course of several weeks, Kilauea flung millions of cubic meters of lava high into the air. So high, in fact, that the lava fountain has gone down in history books as one of the highest in the world. And we asked you if you had any clue how high that fountain was. Well, it measured a stunning 1,900 feet, which would have topped the Empire State Building. And that's it for today's quiz. If you have one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Betty Guerin from The Greenhouse. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
It's easy to get caught up in the urban life, especially if you live on Oahu, in the state's population core. The beauties of nature are not that far away. Often they're tantalizingly close. But you have to make a little extra effort to get off the beaten track and onto one of this island's many hiking trails. The members of the Hawaiian Trail and Mountain Club do make that extra effort, and they know where the best places are to leave the world behind. Guy Archer is the president of the club, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, we're in a pretty densely populated part of the city where we're sitting now, and we could be at a trailhead in, what, 10 minutes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's from Manoa Valley or
Makiki.
Makiki. There's just trailheads all along the mountain range, running from here all the way out Eva.
And from that trailhead, it wouldn't take very long for us to be in a place where the city was very far away.
The trails that Hawaiian Trail and Mountain Club maintain, they run anywhere from, you know, short 3-5 mile trails to as much as 13 miles. So it's all you have to do is walk up and out for a mile or two, and you're away from the traffic noise and all the hustle bustle of downtown.
The 13-mile trail, that's probably what, a pretty good day, right?
That's a long day. A lot of our hikes start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and of course, you want to be back down by 4 or 5
sure.
before the sun is starting to get low in the sky.
Do you want to carry water on most of the trails on this island?
Well, yeah. Everybody on anything more than a mile or two, you're going to want to have either a canteen, or more likely now in a little day pack, you would have a reservoir of water.
Sure.
And that's
Camelback kind of thing?
Camelback type thing, yeah. That's the preferred thing now, definitely.
What are the things that inexperienced hikers forget to do or forget to take along? I'm just thinking of, you know, bottled water and things like that.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I would focus on footwear is one of the keys to, even if you're walking a mile or two on city streets, you want to have, good footwear that you're comfortable with. And certainly on the trail, you're going to look for any kind of hike that's going uphill and over rough ground. You're going to want to have, unless you're experienced, you're going to want to have something that protects your ankles, because one thing you don't want to do is strain or sprain your ankle mm-hmm. or otherwise incur an injury. So,
Up at a higher, you know, up at the kind of elevations where you're doing a lot of hiking, there's pretty uneven surfaces.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And slippery sometimes when it's raining. So you want to have a shoe that has a good sole, Vibram or something like that. Yes.
Yeah. And that's another thing of thinking about the inexperienced hiker might make the mistake of not realizing that it does frequently rain in mid-afternoon here in Hawaii.
Yeah. Right. And of course, for beginning hikers, it's nice to go with a group, and that's why an organization like Hawaiian Trail and Mountain Club is something that people who are interested in hiking should be looking into. We have a website, so there's a lot of information online.
And when you do a hike, you have, what did you call it, a hike coordinator?
Well, yes. One of the things that Hawaiian Trail and Mountain Club, I mean, from 1910, this organization has been in business. So we have a very careful program of trail maintenance, which happens on a lot of our trails a week or two before the actual hike occurs. Mm-hmm. So there's a smaller group that goes out and clears vegetation. And the hike coordinator, or maybe an assistant of the hike coordinator, will go out with the trail clearers to see what the conditions are. Mm-hmm. So that on the day of the hike, we've got a good trail. We may know where there are, if there are going to be problems, where those problems are.
Mm-hmm. How many people on an average hike organized by the club?
Yeah, it varies greatly from
20 or 30 people?
From a half a dozen to 20 or 30 would be typical.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes as many as 40 or 45 people.
I would assume that when you get a group that large, there's some emphasis on minimizing the impact to the environment, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the walking on a trail is pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
We're not picking or taking native shrubs or flowers. Occasionally, there may be mountain apples that are falling or ready to fall off the trees, and mm-hmm. people will pick those. Guava, some people will pick the guava, which is an invasive species. But, the impact is really very minimal, I would say.
Have visitors found out about you folks yet?
We, based on what we're seeing in terms of the website and the amount of activity, yes, people from the mainland are looking at what the club is doing in terms of hike schedules.
Because I would think that people from the mainland might be surprised at the degree to which, for instance, at the number of invasives that you will find on a hike.
At lower elevations, for sure, yeah. And you know, keeping boots clean is, of course, one of the key ways to prevent the dandelions from popping up on Hawaiian trails.
That would involve a certain amount of education of the hikers, right?
Yeah. At the start of each hike, there's the hike coordinator will describe briefly the hike and give other instruction to the group.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage people to carry cell phones or the walkie-talkie, the FRS communication. That's very helpful in terms of especially the walkie-talkies, in terms of the group communicating and keeping in touch with each other.
How many different trails do you think you've been on around this island, Guy?
Dozen? Yeah, dozens and dozens. And also Maui has some nice hiking. There's a little club on Maui that does hiking, mm-hmm. and Kauai's got some beautiful trails.
What's a good recommendation for the beginning hiker on this island?
Well, I think you probably want to find something near to where you live, something that is relatively easy to do if you're just starting out.
Like, say, Makiki, Manoa Falls?
Yeah, right. Manoa Falls can get a little muddy, mm-hmm. but it's a nice drive to the back of Manoa Valley there. And and so that you get comfortable with your gear and your footwear.
Yeah. So maybe better to do a couple of short hikes before you go for the 13-mile all-day higher elevation
hike. Yeah, definitely.
Guy, thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
All right, thank
you,
Chris.
Good to have you. Guy Archer is the president of the Hawaiian Trail and Mountain Club, and you can learn more about the organization on our HPR website.
That's where I feel I ought to be going. Blue sky above me and green earth below. Don't even matter.
Virtuoso guitarist Ian O'Sullivan has been described as thoughtful by Classical Guitar Magazine and delightful by the Honolulu Star Advertiser. In his Atherton debut, Ian played to a standing-room-only audience. This year, he's promising a combination of Bach and Paraguayan composer Agustin Barrios, as well as local composers Jeff Peterson, Bailey Matsuda, and Byron Yasui, when he performs in HBR's Atherton studio on Saturday, May 18th at 7:30. Reservations at 955-8821 during business hours.
There's more, it turns out, to lending money than just dollars and cents.
We were persuaded to give loans to people who didn't have the means to repay them. So, essentially, we were setting people up for failure.
I'm Kai Risnell, Installment Lenders, in the second part of our special collaboration with ProPublica, next time on Marketplace from APN.
This evening at 6, following selected shorts.
Beth Ann, we talked to Sam Lowe, author of Hawaiki Rising, and it looks to be the most comprehensive book to date about the whole phenomena of rediscovering the ancient ways of the Polynesian wayfinders. And it's a phenomenal story.
It's a great story, and it's not just about doing something on faith. It's just about a different way of knowing, which may be in part why Hawaii is so attractive to people who come to visit us. Certainly now it's getting another shot in the arm with that Parents Magazine article that'll come out next month. But that different sense of knowing is in part, I think, what we talked about earlier as we looked at that article, and certainly what Sam was talking about in the interview with you.
Well, as so often happens, the truth is far more interesting than whatever legends might have grown up before. And, you know, I'm thinking of this, of Hawaiki Rising and the wayfinding story as debunking the whole thing of Kon-Tiki, which for years was this sort of prevailing and rather cockamamie theory about about how everybody got where they got in the Pacific. And as I say, the truth is more interesting.
Well, yeah, especially when it comes to looking at issues of gender equity and parity. And I guess we just have to look in many different directions,
exactly.
As we heard later in the show from Tracy Whelan. So there you have it. That's the show for Tuesday. We will be back with you tomorrow morning. And we'll be moving on from the ledge a little bit. We're going to get an update on human trafficking and the next steps for advocates working to shut it down.
Plus, Iona Contemporary Dance Theater continues its innovative ways with a new e-season.
Have a different slice of the conversation or want to suggest one? Post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
Past shows and links to more information are on the HPR archive on the website hawaiipublicradio.org. You also can sign up for the podcast. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you back here tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.